Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, there's an election coming up in November. The results will reflect a major confluence of events and trends. To name a few, the COVID-19 pandemic impact and response, the nationwide protests against systematic racism and police brutality, and the state of our economy, our healthcare system, and our partisan political divide. As always, KUOW is exploring ways to help our listeners stay informed about these issues. In June, we presented a series of conversations called Inside 2020. It featured NPR voices you likely know well. In this episode of Speakers Forum, you'll hear excerpts from the series. The conversations touch on local and national political reporting in 2020, what may be in store in November, and how the pandemic is changing newsrooms. First up, NPR's All Things Considered co-host Mary Louise Kelly chats with KUOW's ATC host Kim Malcolm. Next, you'll hear from NPR's White House correspondent Tamara Keith in conversation with KUOW's Seattle Now host Patricia Murphy. And finally, we'll present a conversation with NPR's White House breaking news reporter Aisha Roscoe. She was interviewed by KUOW's Northwest News Network reporter Austin Jenkins. To hear the full conversations, go to KUOW.org, click on the podcast page, and choose Speakers Forum, or search for KUOW on YouTube.
You know, I've heard the term inflection point more than once this week. And between the ongoing protests over police brutality across the country and continuing impacts from the pandemic, all of this is heading towards the November election. I want to touch on the protests briefly and the election. How are you thinking the demands that we're hearing from protesters and this new revitalized focus on systemic racism, how is that going to play out during this election season, do you think?
I don't think this is something that's going to go away and 2 weeks later we won't be talking about it the way that so many things have, because, you know, as we all know, we're living through the biggest news story of our times already with mm-hmm. the pandemic and the economic crisis and the presidential year, the presidential election year. And we've had plans being announced today from Al Sharpton speaking at the memorial service for George Floyd in Minneapolis, talking about a march on Washington, which I think would, if it comes off, would be a day or two after the Republican National Convention, if that happens, is scheduled to unfold. This suddenly becomes one of the defining issues of this election, which I don't know that we're expecting. But yes, to your point about inflection point, I wake up every morning and some mornings feel very hopeful and other mornings feel, just to be honest, sadness at all we have lost. It almost knocks me down some days, and trying to figure out, you know, it's my job to try to find words powerful enough to tell that story. And there are some days where you feel like you hit it and some days where you think, I got to get up again and try it again the next day. It's hard. Yeah.
What gets you through on those days when it's hard and it's sad and you still have to show up and do the job?
I am eternally grateful for having the kind of job that where it's really not a choice, where producers will hunt me down and we have to get 2 hours on the air every day, whether I feel up to it or not, it's going to happen. So you might as well give it your best shot every day because you're there. Mm-hmm. I had this moment where I just really stopped and thought, getting on the plane for the first time in months, getting to travel this week. My producer had gone by NPR to pick up all of our gear before we went. And we, you know, knew that we were going to need to bring Clorox wipes and gloves and N95 masks and all the rest. And I was planning to travel carry on. And she shows up and they are, you know, we're traveling with full body armor and helmets and goggles. I've traveled with that stuff before, but going into, you know, Iraq, going to Afghanistan, right. going into declared war zones. And to get on a plane to my hometown, to get on Delta flight and fly into Hartsfield Airport in Atlanta, thinking I'm going to need this stuff in the trunk of my car. It just, it took me a minute
to process that.
Yeah. To go find a new suitcase and put it in there and think these are the times we are living through. To say nothing of the fact that, you know, as a journalist, we are trained, as you know, to be the ones who run toward the chaos. And I was on a plane to Atlanta, and I'm looking at what's happening in Washington. Monday night was the night at Lafayette Square when President Trump came up and held up the Bible. And as I'm landing, I'm getting messages from editors saying, maybe we might need you back in Washington tomorrow. Sorted it out. But it speaks to just the onslaught of defining events of our time, and they seem to come at us every damn day.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, I mean, and that is a question for you and for your team at ATC. When things are so compressed, happening, as you say, it's an onslaught, not just daily, but hourly, things are changing and they feel very momentous. How do you and your team prioritize what you're going to cover and how you're going to cover it?
Yeah, it's a great question. We're old school. For many years, All Things Considered has had a 9:30 a.m. morning meeting, and you show up and you pitch your ideas and we make a plan. I say we're old school because it feels so antiquated, the idea that at 9:30 in the morning we could possibly have a plan that's going to still feel
that'll last
relevant by 5 or 6 in the evening. It just moves too fast. That worked 10 years ago. It really doesn't work now. I mean, what is the alternative? Not to have a plan? Obviously, if we're trying to get reporters on the ground in certain places, we need to get them out the door. And if we're trying to put in interview requests for people, we need to get those requests out early. So there is value to planning, but we spend a lot more time ripping things up and throwing it out. That's one point I would make, is that I am always thinking, you know, one of my fears is that we will be missing the forest for the trees, because there's so many developments. We want to bring you the latest. We want to be on top of everything. But sometimes my line producer is racing into the studio saying, we're going to pull this and hold it because this just happened. And I'm thinking, okay, but is that actually more important in the grand scheme of things? I know this thing happened at 10 in the morning, but it still really matters. Mm-hmm. And people in Seattle and in California and in the West Coast deserve the whole day, not just what happened, you know, in the last 5 minutes of it. So that's one thing on our mind. I will say I look at the 2 hours of All Things Considered and often think, is there an opportunity? Is there any prospect that I will laugh or smile at any point in that hour? Because if I'm not, you're not. And there has to be, you don't need to have yucks on in a week like this week. It's not, I don't mean we need to do silliness at the expense of serious things that need to be covered.
No, but humanity.
Opportunities for humanity. It's not a terrible thing. You know, now, especially now, we need opportunities to smile and laugh and seek that relief. So I look at that. I look at, you know, that those calls I was getting from editors on Monday night, you might need to get on a plane back to Washington Monday. Mm-hmm. Those come in and have relentlessly since 2016. I'm good friends with a couple of journalists here who moved to Jerusalem in 2016 to go be Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. And they gave up and came home because they kept saying, the story is in Washington. It's impossible to leave Washington. How could, if you're a journalist, the story is always here. And it is easy to succumb to just becoming very inside the beltway, because there is this relentless fire hose of news here, all of which needs to be covered and fact-checked and analyzed and put into context. But I also will go through just looking at the rundown for All Things Considered and look at it and think, hang on, there's not a single, we have a huge international desk. That is our crown jewel at NPR, is that we have correspondents all over the world. There's nothing outside of Washington in the show. We need some of this needs to hold, or needs to go to Morning Edition, or needs to run tomorrow. We need to make space to get you out in the world. and out of the just, as I say, just the fire hose of news that is coming out of, frankly, the White House every single day. And that is hard too, to try to figure out, you know, every twist and turn of that. If you cover it, then you're not covering something else. There's 2 hours is a long show, but it is not infinite, and that we triage stuff every day.
That's right.
I'm always looking at that and thinking, do I ignore it? Is that the responsible thing to do? Do I cover it, fact check it, give it context? But then again, you're not hearing what happened in Moscow today or in Nairobi or in Minneapolis or in Seattle, because it can't just be that all the time. So that is a challenge.
It is a challenge, yeah, and it's a conscious decision. Helps to have teammates to try and work on the balance. Yeah. So this pandemic, the angles, there's so many different threads to follow. Are there some that you think are particularly interesting that may not get as much coverage as you think they deserve?
That's a good question. It's the question we're always asking ourselves, trying to figure out, you know, how to just, is this infinitely huge story that has upended every inch of our lives. I did a story. It was fascinating and also really frustrating and unsatisfying about a week ago, where we just took stock of all of the things that we still don't know. You know, we were exactly 3 or 4 months after the first death in the US, February. So I guess we were 4 months out. And there's still so many just basic questions about how it spreads and who's spreading it that are relevant looking back to try to understand, but also really relevant as we all start to emerge slowly from our homes and crawl back out into the daylight a little bit as things start to reopen. And we're trying to make decisions about our behavior and our risk. So some very basic questions are still open. You know, how does it spread? Who's spreading it? What are my risks? Can you get it again? If you've had it once, are you immune? For how long? And we keep, you know, the best scientists in the world are working on that, and they don't know the answers. But those are ones that intrigue me to keep asking. There's no shortage of conspiracy theories and misinformation on that story, as every other one we cover. So trying to unpack what the facts are, trying to fact check it in real time is a challenge.
Thank you for mentioning that. Misinformation online, that's its own whole category. We're doing a series on it right now, AUOW. But when you talk about fact checking, we got questions about that from our listeners, and that was a question for me as well. These are new challenges posed under this administration about checking information, fact checking it at a pace and at a speed we had not encountered before. How do you feel NPR and All Things Considered has evolved to meet that? Are we doing a good enough job, do you think?
Well, I mean, we are continuing to evolve, and it is a real and ongoing challenge. We from the beginning of this administration have wrestled with it and tried many things from, you know, during speeches or press conference, having the transcript post and be fact-checking it live on our website in real time. This was just said, the correspondent who covers that every day is annotating the transcript with live notes. Mm-hmm. You can do it on Twitter, you can do it on our website. We're doing that. We have done a lot of kind of pre-fact-checking and pre-buttals of events when we know what time they're going to start. So State of the Union, starting our live coverage half an hour early, laying out here are the facts on certain things. Mm-hmm. Here's what you need to know. Cover the event and then fact check it afterward. It is not perfect because a lot of people aren't listening half an hour before or for the half hour afterward. Mm-hmm. It's a disadvantage that we have at NPR compared to TV, which can do split screen. Mm-hmm. or can have a cryon going across the bottom, or can show the live thing and then have facts spooling down one side. So we're trying to be creative about it. One very recent innovation, this is coronavirus era, where we've all been working remotely, has been live fact checking for me while doing interviews via Slack. I don't know if you're using Slack at KU.
We are. How's that working for you?
I hate Slack. I hate it. It's just too many messaging platforms all at once. However, it has been enormously useful for things like the following. I last month interviewed the director of the CDC, Robert Redfield. Mm-hmm. And you obviously prepare and go in. Inevitably, if I'm interviewing someone like that, he's the expert. I'm questioning him. He knows more about it than I do. That's almost, you know, every interview I do, the person I'm interviewing by definition should know more about it than I do because they're the expert, which is why we're interviewing them. You prepare for it. You know what you're trying to get out of him. But what Slack has enabled us to do is to have, one of our science desk editors and one of our science desk reporters, and I'm in a Slack chat room with them that I can see while I'm interviewing somebody. So I can be at home. You know, the old school way, as you'll know, but I'll just explain it for people listening. 6 months ago, I would be in the studio. My editor would be in the studio. Guest is saying something. I'm trying desperately to fact check it in real time. My editor can whisper in my ear, but you want to keep that to a bare minimum because then I can't hear what the guest is saying. It's incredibly disruptive. Slack, you know, the head of the CDC can say something, and our science correspondent, who's just maybe done a series on that exact point, can ping me something saying, that's true, but in six other cases, this happened. Mm-hmm. And I can, in real time, you know, you don't want to cross a line where I'm being fed questions. It's my job to have a conversation with somebody and just asking them. But just for the very quick, I can't be an expert on everything. That's what our correspondents are, though. You know, our science correspondents do know, you know, on a level close to being on par with the people working at CDC, this stuff, they're covering it day in, day out. And they, through their reporting, have been enormously useful in suggesting, you know, follow-ups while I'm in the middle of an interview. And that has been great and is useful in things like this. You don't get it, you know, when you're at the State Department with Mike Pompeo, you're on your own. But for things like this where we're in studio and I have a computer, that has been very, very helpful too. It's like having, you know, an army of experts just right there helping me. So crowdsourcing the fact checking is, I guess, the best way to put it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's a work in progress for sure. Very interesting. And as you say, it's an evolving art, and we are doing our best to stay on top of it. So you brought up Mike Pompeo. Our Secretary of State. You ended up being almost part of the story after you had that interview with him earlier this year, which is not a position you would often find yourself in. It's not a position many journalists would want to be in. He was quite aggressive towards you after the mics were turned off, and later on he claimed that you had lied while setting up the interview. You had not. You had the emails to prove it. A listener touched on this with a question. They wanted to know, how did you stay so calm in that moment? He was a large man. He was speaking loudly, I understand.
He was. He was angry. It's the job. You go in, you be professional, you do your job. It's something to be called a liar by the Secretary of State, official State Department letterhead. And to be sworn at in his office, and to be challenged to find Ukraine on a map. Not the direction I was expecting that interview to go. But this is what we do. This is what I came to do, is to put questions that deserve answers, that everybody out there listening deserves an answer to people in positions of power and hold them to account. And I think you stay calm because you know you're there doing your job, that the questions were fair, They were rigorous. They were fair. They needed to be asked. If they're not getting answered, you ask them again. In an interview like that, I always go in immaculately prepared, knowing that I had kind of two or three questions I actually really wanted to know the answers to. It's the only questions I went in with was two or three questions, but thinking, what is he going to say? And being prepared to fact check it in real time.
That was Kim Malcolm interviewing NPR's Mary Louise Kelly. Here, KUOW reporter and Seattle Now host Patricia Murphy talks with NPR's White House correspondent Tamara Keith.
Everything has changed about the way we're doing reporting now, except for the job itself, right? The way we're doing it is different. How has your job changed since the pandemic?
Well, I haven't left my house much. There's been a lot of texting and calling and doing source work that way. Though yesterday it was pretty exciting. I did my first in-person source meeting since the pandemic began. Mobile ordered Starbucks for my source and I met outside the Starbucks. We walked in and individually grabbed our waiting beverages, wore our masks, tried to use straws. Sometimes our masks were not on because we were drinking coffee, but kept our 6 feet of distance and walked around the White House.
Yeah.
Outdoors.
Yeah. It's hard to have real private conversations when you have to be that far apart.
Right. Well, it's also hard to have private conversations when, everybody's trapped in the office and trapped at home. It's been an interesting challenge. But
do you miss being on the road? The last time you were covering Hillary Clinton when we were in a presidential election. Do you miss that?
I was so, what is the right word? I had such severe Stockholm syndrome after 2016 that I purchased a shower head that was the same shower head that they had at Marriott hotels.
Oh, is this really? Really?
Yeah, I'm not kidding. No, this is the truth. So of course, in some ways I do miss being on the road. What I really miss is interviewing people, like normal, real people. I miss that a lot. Now all I do is interview. It's funny. It's easier to get members of Congress and governors on the phone these days, oddly enough. So I interview politicians. I get a lot of background quotes from White House officials. And I miss people. I miss people badly. We are really struggling and brainstorming how to replicate that safely.
Yeah.
One thing that I'm going to start working on the next few days is I did a series back in 2011 when I was a business reporter about people who were long-term unemployed. So I followed six people who had been out of work basically since the Great Recession started and followed their experience getting back into work. Well, I have stayed in touch with most of them. And my plan is to revisit them now that we're in another recession.
That's a great idea. And
I'm
it's a real testament to beat reporting and staying in touch with your sources. I love that kind of stuff, right? Where you've been around long enough to be able to go back and check in. I love that. So tell me, I have a couple of audience questions here. And one of them is how the pandemic is affecting access to the White House for information. And now obviously your physical access has been impacted, but how about information coming out of the White House?
It hasn't changed dramatically. They are as responsive as they've ever been, which for, getting official information is not very responsive. So instead of walking up to an empty office and saying, oh gosh, when is Kaylee going to be back? I send emails into the ether. It is not markedly worse. It is not markedly harder. It's just different. And if you want, I can sort of go through what I'm on the White House Correspondents Association board, like what we've done to make the White House safe for our press corps.
Yeah. Yeah. Were they thinking about that for you, or were you taking that initiative for yourselves in the press corps?
We were taking that initiative for ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, it was in some collaboration with the White House, but Now it's very clear that the White House would like to see every seat full in the briefing room. And we are simply not ready for that. It's not safe.
Yeah.
Because there's no way to maintain social distance. And if everyone were in the briefing room, then everyone would be in the workspaces. And let me just say that the press area, the briefing room, everything about the press experience at the White House that you've seen on television and movies makes it seem far larger than it really is.
Yeah.
If you walk into the press briefing room at the White House, and I swear anyone, the first time they walk in, the reaction is, huh, this is smaller than it is than it looks on TV. Like every person.
yeah.
It's underwhelming. And now that we're extremely conscious of your proximity to other human beings, it's a little scary.
Yeah.
So we're trying to continue to maintain this reduced footprint, but that also cuts off access for people. I mean, you know, it's the only way many people have to try to get an answer from the press secretary or from the president is to be able to either shout a question or raise a hand in the briefing and ask a question. And only I think 14 reporters a day can be in the room.
Yeah. I think you mentioned when we were chatting that you've been in there twice during this time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how do you choose that? How do you decide who gets to go in?
Oh, well, I mean, every seat has a rotation. Right. And so there are different print seat rotations. There's a radio seat rotation. There's independent TV. It's all very complicated. But even the television networks, who typically all demand to be everywhere all the time, have gone to pool coverage. So there's really only one camera crew in the briefing room during the briefing, which was a major concession. I mean, everybody is sacrificing for the health and safety of the press corps.
This kind of gets to another listener question that I'm reading here. And I think it touches on, you know, having to deal with a pool situation now. This listener would like to know if you share information among each other now that the number of people in the room is smaller.
Yes. Well, so typically in the briefing room, if something's happening in the briefing room, it's on television. But already we have a system of pools. So there's a print pooler, there's a radio pooler, there's a TV pooler, because like the whole press corps can't go into the Oval Office, for instance. So we already had a pool systems in place. It's a very important part of covering the White House is this pool system. We go wherever the president goes. We fly on Air Force One when the president flies on Air Force One. We go in the motorcade. We're everywhere the president is. I mean, it's like technically body watch, but you know, it's important.
Yeah.
And so yes, we share. We have a whole system.
Yeah. Another listener question here. He would like to know if you, over the past years, have had any meaningful one-on-one questions with President Trump, one-on-one interviews with President Trump that were meaningful.
So no one at NPR has had a one-on-one interview with President Trump or candidate Trump. I have asked questions. My colleagues, Aisha and Franco and Mara, have certainly asked questions and been called on by the president. I would argue that I had a meaningful recent experience. I don't know, meaningful may not be the right word, but when President Trump went to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in early March, it was his sort of last trip before everything came crashing down.
Right.
And I was on that trip. And so we're in the CDC and he starts taking questions and there aren't that many of us. When you're in the pool, there are 11 people and not all of them are reporters. So there's like maybe four reporters who can ask five reporters who will ask questions. And I just kept asking, you know, I asked, you know, does the lack of testing mean that the American people are being deceived about the severity of the coronavirus problem? The answer was not yes, though, of course, the answer was yes. I mean, deceived may not be the right word, but certainly no one had a sense of how bad it was because the lack of testing was hiding how bad it was. I asked, it was back when like cruise ships were a thing. And and he was like being really non-committal about whether he wanted to let a cruise ship dock in San Francisco. So I sort of pressed him on that. And then he said the thing about, well, I like the numbers where they are now. And if we let them off the boat, then our numbers are going to go up and that wouldn't be fair. So you can get, you know, sound bites, you can get tape, you can get him to answer just about anything. He says what he's thinking frequently. Right. He just says a lot of stuff.
He does say a lot of stuff. And again, it gets to another listener question here about the challenging environment that you're working in right now and your ability to try to combat some of the disinformation that comes out of the White House. That's a really tough spot and something that we're not really used to so obviously coming out of the White House. There's always spin, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
There is always spin. There is always... selective use of numbers, for instance. But typically White Houses don't put out blatantly false numbers that are really easy to check. Because White Houses, past White Houses, certainly the Obama White House, they would be like shamed into fixing it or apologizing. And this president is, you know, unmoored from those sorts of concerns. To put it mildly. So in terms of fact-checking, it's an interesting challenge though, right? So do you fact-check absolutely everything? Do you, you know, he tweets the thing about the man in Buffalo who obviously was not, you know, an Antifa radical that was pretending to be injured. Do you rush and put something on the web or put something on the air about that? It's an open question because every time you spend time and resources and airtime on a conspiracy theory and a falsehood, you're also amplifying it. You're giving it oxygen at the same time that you're trying to fact check it. It's a real major challenge that fact checkers and fact checking broadly faces that we haven't fully figured out how to address as like, you know, the fourth estate, as journalism more broadly.
Well, and the level of disinformation that circulates under the guise of real news in itself embeds that in the psyche of certain people. So I guess, you know, it's difficult to call out untruths and have it get traction in the same way it may have in the last administration.
Yes. And, you know, the lie travels around the world many times before the truth ever gets a chance.
Yeah. We've also seen an unprecedented number of attacks on journalists. You know, the president is not shy about going after journalists, about calling people out that he's angry with. I wonder, for someone who covers the president, how you try to stay neutral through this when your profession is being attacked.
So I am fairly emotionally detached. I don't take it personally. I don't involve my personal feelings in the work. And I do not, you know, I do not sit and say, oh my gosh, the mean man called me an enemy of the people again.
Yeah.
You know, like I know that it is a tactic. I know that it is just part of his shtick. And it's dangerous. It's dangerous for journalists in America. It's extremely dangerous for journalists in other parts of the world. But like I can't spend every day obsessing about it when I just need to do the work, need to tell the stories, need to try to shine light. And I'm not interested in being the opposition party. As Steve Bannon called us, the former Trump advisor, that's not, that doesn't actually help journalism. It doesn't help our institution. It has the potential to further degrade our institution. And it's not like we're doing very well in the eyes of the American public right now.
We are going to be voting in November, and it's either going to be just past or just around the time they're predicting another coronavirus bump. A lot of states are thinking about mail-in voting. We've been doing that here.
Don't you guys do that?
10 years we've been doing, 12 years we've been doing mail-in voting, Tamara. We love it. We love it. We love it. What's the future for the election and polls and mail-in votes?
I don't know that this is all going to get resolved by November. I think it's going to be messy. And I think that as journalists, we have a responsibility right now to inform our audiences that mail-in voting, provisional ballots, some of these things that there's going to be a lot more of this time than there have been in previous elections, it takes longer. You may not get election results on election night, and it isn't some nefarious conspiracy. It's just the way these things work. It's not like somebody out there harvesting zombie ballots. It's just the way these things happen.
A lot boring for a lot more boring for reporters on election night.
Oh, but maybe we could go to bed early. I don't know.
I don't know. I missed the horse race.
Seems unlikely, but every time we say, "Oh, maybe we can go to bed early," I remember on Iowa night there was like this meeting on the night of the Iowa caucuses, the meeting before we went to go on the air, and the executive producer of our events coverage was like, "So we might be done by like what, 9:30 or something?" And God, was it like 2 a.m. when we finished? It was, and we didn't know for 2 days.
Yeah.
Or three days.
I'm a Murphy. I never make predictions, man. As soon as I say we're going to wrap up early, we're going all night for sure.
Yeah, no, so. It's like, don't make predictions. But our election system is pretty messy. It's not a federal system. It is a state and local system, and mostly a local system. And it is also, it functions best with large margins. Because like once you need to like look under the hood, it's a little unpleasant.
Yeah.
So,
one way to put it.
Yeah. And you know, you don't want people to lose faith in their in the electoral system and in voting broadly. But it's messy.
Yeah.
And we don't have easy solutions for things like ties.
Yes. I'm thinking way back actually to hanging chads. It goes way back. Goes way back.
Oh.
Way back.
Yes.
We have about 1 minute left, but I want one last question for you, because you're bringing up something that I have heard people talk about, who are worried that if Trump does lose, not by a large margin, he will try to seize the election and try to halt the results. Can he do that? Is that possible?
I mean, the thing is, though, elections are administered by cities and states and counties. I mean, I'm sure there's some crazy thing that somebody could come up with, but our system is not designed to make that possible.
Great. Great. Settled, people. Settled.
Now he may not accept the results. Our system works best when people concede.
Yeah.
I suspect that someone like a Mitch McConnell would say something if it came to that.
Yeah, yeah. Tamara Keith, what a pleasure. It has been talking with you. Thank you.
Yes. Oh, also, he could win. That's the other thing.
Absolutely.
Like, he could just straight up win.
Totally. Totally. Well, we will see. We will see. We will see. Thank you so much for taking the time, Tamara Keith.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into Speakers Forum for these conversations from KUOW's Inside 2020 series. You just heard from NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Here, KUOW's Northwest News Network reporter Austin Jenkins interviews NPR White House breaking news reporter Aisha Roscoe.
It was a lot to get to, but I do want to acknowledge and just start out with the fact that it has been a historic several weeks in this country. It has also been an emotional few weeks for Black Americans, for Black journalists, just colleague to colleague. I'd like to check in with you and ask, how are you doing?
It, it has been a challenging time. I think there's no need to try to sugarcoat it. I mean, people forget, like, even just, you know, as a journalist covering the White House, we started out the year with impeachment, which was a lot. It was very busy for me, at least. And then you go from that to just a little slice of the campaign and then a pandemic. And now these issues that have been going on for hundreds of years, but now once again bubbling to the surface as a Black American, seeing the protests, seeing the death of George Floyd, and all of these other things happening back to back, it takes a lot, you know. And I think that it's hard as a journalist because you don't get to unplug. You know, if I wasn't a journalist, I wouldn't listen to everything. I could take a break. But you have to, you know, be here in this moment. And you have to, you know, I'm grateful for being able to be here and to be a witness and to be someone and to have a voice in this moment. But yeah, it's a challenge.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that with us. And thanks for the work you do. You are a trusted voice. And the fact that you're there covering the White House for us and the president, this presidency in particular, is much appreciated. Can you tell us a little bit about how you found your way into journalism? You know, a short mini version maybe of your life story. But I'm always interested, you know, why journalism? Why the news business?
Yeah, so I would say, so the short version is that I just, you know, I was always into reading and always into history and all of that. And so I just gravitated to reading the newspaper, even as a kid, even in, you know, high school. So I just, whenever there was like a journalism thing to do, I did it. So I worked on my, you know, there was my local newspaper had a teen section. I did that. They also had, and you know, so I was on the school newspaper. I went to Howard University. I majored in print journalism, and really kind of the rest is history. I worked for a very long time at Reuters, which is a news agency. And then now I've been at NPR for about 2 years now, going on, yeah, more than 2 years now, about two and a half. So
just briefly, why the transition from print, from Reuters to public radio?
You know, I was at Reuters for 10 years and it gave me a good foundation. You have to be fast, you have to be accurate, and you have to, you know, get the news out, the facts. So it gave me a good foundation. I think I was ready to try something new. And what I've enjoyed about being at NPR, especially doing the politics podcast and everything else, I've got to show a little bit more of my personality, and the audience for NPR, they are so committed, and there's just a different way that they interact with reporters, because they feel like it's personal to them because they hear you on the radio, they hear you in their homes, they hear you in their car. And so it's a much more personal connection. So I really like that.
Yeah. The byline is a big deal, but that personal connection, the voice that is unparalleled. And it is a special relationship we have with our listeners. There's so much news, so much going on. It's hard to even know where to begin, but let's begin with the John Bolton book, because there's a lot of interest. It's not the first time a former administration official has come out with a quote unquote tell-all or something critical of the president, but that seems like with the Justice Department's help, the president is doing a lot to try to quash this, keep it from getting out. Although, you know, it's already leaked out, or portions of it have, but what's he worried about, and how big a deal is this? Is it going to be a blip, or could this, you know, crumble the presidency?
You know, I think that, well, this presidency has been through a lot of tell-all books and a lot of, you know, this is kind of, I would almost say that this is the sort of thing that I think the Trump administration is more used to dealing with, honestly, like to have a former official accusing them of. So now I will say yeah, they have practice. But I will say that John Bolton, being in the position that he was, National Security Advisor, and the charges that he's making against the president are very serious. So I don't want to downplay them at all. But I do think that this White House has, they went through impeachment, that they already got through that. And so I think they feel very secure in their position. But President Trump is not someone who, you know, who is, you know, he views himself as someone who is a fighter. And so if you are going to try to come against him, yeah, he's going to throw the book at you legally. And that's what he's done with all of this, whether it was with his taxes, any of this stuff, he throws up every legal challenge. At this point with this book, the cow is already out, or the horse is out of the barn, right? Like, people have copies of the book, so you're not going to be able to, you know, keep this book hidden. But I think right now, it's really about making John Bolton pay, and maybe even with like his profits from the book, and really just making it very difficult for John Bolton. And it's probably personal, right? Like, he just doesn't like that John Bolton has said these negative things about him. But I think that this is the sort of landscape that the president is used to dealing with, saying, oh, they said this negative thing about me, but it's not true. You know, just going, you know, it doesn't matter. This is a type of fight that they're very used to having.
Yeah. One of our audience members is wondering if there's any revelations that have come out so far that surprise you or confirm something you already thought, anything that's just jumping off the page at the moment.
I think there are a lot of things that are surprising. I think the stuff about him directly saying China to Xi of China, we need your help. Like, for me to get reelected, I need you to buy these, you know, I need you to buy these soybeans from the farmers. You have to help me. The fact that it was so explicit, obviously also him saying that he was Bolton accusing the president, or saying that the president said that he was okay with the Chinese building concentration camps for the Uyghurs, which is, you know, a population there that is being oppressed. That is shocking and surprising. To have someone saying that they were in the room or when these things were happening. I mean, I think that, like I said, I don't want to say that these aren't serious. And they're also shocking to have someone at this level saying, not that they necessarily heard it, but, or not saying that this is hearsay, but saying, yeah, I was there when the president directly asked for help with the election. That's pretty huge, right? Like, that's a big deal. And the stuff about the Uyghurs is really... it's really jarring.
Yeah. What is, and there's so many other topics we could hit on, including the president's not taking on the Supreme Court because he's had a couple of rulings that he didn't see in his favor. He's talking about new Supreme Court justices that he might appoint. But let's just step back. You covered, if I'm remembering correctly, the last year of the Obama White House for Reuters, and now obviously the Trump presidency. What is it like, you know, being on the and I know on top of it all, you know, even on a normal day, it's interesting, but you layer in all of the things you've talked about that are going on in the news in 2020. What's it like?
I think it's hard to describe it because it has been, but what I would say is the chaos that you see like from the outside, it is that chaotic inside. Like, it is a chaotic place. It is a chaotic environment. And it's something that it's hard to know from day to day, like, what's going to happen. You just never know. Like, President Trump could tweet something and it changes the whole tone of your day. Like, you thought you were going to be doing one thing, but then he sends out a tweet and it's a whole other thing.
I was picturing, you know, do you have to wake up in the middle of the night and check your phone to see if he's been tweeting it?
It happens. I mean, you know, that when he sent that tweet, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, that was at 1 a.m. And I was awake because so much was going on at that moment. And I have alerts. So my phone beeps when President Trump tweets. And so I saw that tweet as it happened. And I knew that this was going to be a serious thing like that.
So what do you do? Just take us inside. What do you do in that moment? It's 1 a.m. He's just tweeted that. I mean, it's not abnormal that he's tweeting in the middle of the night, but this is so striking and shocking.
So in that moment, we're not on the air, and I knew that they weren't going to want something right then. But so I could Well, I tried to go to sleep. It took me a while to go to sleep that night. I'll be honest. But the next day, it was just Twitter had, you know, put a warning message on it. It was, and then he was responding. It was just all this snowball effect. So the next day, I was writing the story for that. I think I was on the air. Maybe we did. I know we did the podcast. It was just, you know, one thing after another, you know, because he had said this statement, and he has these tweets that cross a line, and even, and he tweets a lot, and a lot of things that he says any other president would have gotten in trouble for. But for this, it was just, this was one of those tweets that crossed a line and that people will remember, I think, for a very long time. And it was just, it was a moment.
Yeah. I want to just pivot to an audience member's question about, you were talking about the chaos in the White House. Are there two or three people currently, and I know that this may be a changing cast of, kind of characters, but official or unofficial, who the president is most listening to? And obviously we're in a campaign season too, but who's influencing his behavior and his actions and decision-making right now, do you think?
Well, I think that the person who influences the president the absolute most is Donald J. Trump. Like, I think he does what he wants to do. But outside of Donald J. Trump and what his gut and his instinct tells him to do, the other people that have a lot of influence is obviously Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner. So his daughter and son-in-law. I think they in the White House are obviously the survivors. And I do think that they will survive. Well, Ivanka will always survive, right? Jared, as long as he stick with Ivanka, he gonna survive too. But they are the people that are extremely influential. I mean, you see Jared has been involved in everything. It almost becomes, you know, people joke about, you know, him trying to get Middle East peace and all these things. But he is very influential with what came out this week with the executive order on policing. That's something that Jared Kushner worked on very, that was something that he was instrumental in. And there's reporting that when President Trump went to St. John's, that was Ivanka Trump's idea. So they do have a lot of influence, and they are the people in the White House who aren't going to get fired. Everybody else, we don't know. You might see the door, but Ivanka and Jared, they're going to be around.
How easy or how hard is it to get administration officials to talk to you candidly on background or off the record about what's really going on behind the scenes?
You know, I mean, it depends. I mean, it can be hard to get people to talk. And sometimes I think part of the issue is that there's a question of, I think one of the hardest things with this administration is when you're trying to figure out what's going on. And sometimes I think people really don't know, because sometimes there doesn't seem to really be a plan, or there doesn't seem, or there, this person is saying this and this person is saying that. And there have been instances where someone who was in a position to know told, you know, told me or told our team that something was going to happen, or the president wasn't going to do this. And this person was in a position to know. And then the president did the exact opposite. And I don't think that person was lying. I think they really didn't know what he was going to do. And so often the plan changed. And so often you'll see that even when they're telling you something, they're saying, as far as I know, in this moment, this is what we're thinking. That could always change. Yeah. And so I think that sometimes there is genuine confusion because people don't know like what's happening. So sometimes when you get a tweet that comes out, the president will put out some statement and you ask about it, they'll just say the tweet speaks for itself. And that just means they don't know what it means, and they don't know what the implications are, and they don't know, you know, what's happening. Right. And that happens.
All of this news is happening in a big election year. And I've noticed just covering a state governor and state government that there's been very little time for our governor who's seeking a third term to actively campaign. I mean, never mind the disruption that COVID-19 has, but it's just been, you know, press conferences every other day and you're having to govern. What are you noticing about kind of governing versus campaigning? And is there a transition that's about to happen or that's happening? How does that work when there's so much going on?
I mean, I do think that there is a, there's a definite, like the president is always really campaigning. Like he's been campaigning even from the beginning. But right now, now that I think that's what the White House wants, they don't want to be talking about the coronavirus. President Trump has made clear he doesn't want to talk about that. He wants to move on to, you know, return to greatness, you know, recovery summer. That's what he wants the focus to be on. And so that's where you can see now they're having, you know, a lot of events that are focused on everything getting restarted, what he's doing for the veterans, what he's doing for the senior citizens, what he's doing for this group. That's what they want to be talking about. The problem, of course, is that the pandemic isn't over. And so I don't, and it doesn't seem like the pandemic is wanting to cooperate with that, but the president is moving forward with campaigning, and he wants to campaign in the traditional way. So, which is rallies.
Right, rallies. This also lends a question about Joe Biden. And one of our audience members is just asking, is the speculation and conversation is picking up over a vice presidential pick for Biden. Who are you guessing might be the pick, if you have a guess? And what do you think about the importance of that role for this Democratic ticket in 2020?
So I don't know who he will pick. There's a lot of speculation that he will pick a Black woman for his vice president, because obviously there has been a huge issue of race in this country because of the way that Black women have really been the backbone of the Democratic Party. And the thought that you need someone who is going to be able to energize young people of color to come out who may not be sold on Joe Biden. Now, does that mean Kamala Harris? Does that mean, you know, Val Demings, who's a congresswoman, but also has who played a big role in impeachment and also was like a police chief? Or Stacey Abrams from Georgia. I think that those women are clearly in the mix. I don't know if that's who he's going to go with. I don't want to, and then I also don't want to, you know, be reductive and just say, well, he needs to pick a Black woman. But I think that there's going to be a question. If he does not, if he makes a different choice, he likely will need to have an explanation for why he did not, because there has been so much call for him to do so.
Yeah. The president is often underestimated. What is your sense? I mean, the polls are not looking good for him right now. The polls in swing states are not looking good for him. Of course, Biden is not out on the campaign trail, and everything, you know, in terms of traditional campaigning has been thrown into disarray. But what is your sense of the president's vulnerability going into this 2020 election?
Well, you know, before the pandemic happened, I mean, he had this booming economy. He is the incumbent. So, I mean, he really had the wind at his back, and that's kind of what he was telling the Wall Street Journal in an interview that, you know, just came out. Like, he did. Now, I think, I do not know what will happen. You know, I don't think anyone knows. So, I mean, I think that's a fact. No one knows what's going to happen. He is still the incumbent. He still has a very strong base. He still has a lot of people that are very enthusiastic about him. I don't think that anyone or any reasonable observer would count him out or say, you know, President Trump is going to have a hard time winning this election. I don't think you can say that at all. But he has a lot of issues now that he did not have before. And I also think we have to be very humble about the fact that we did not know in January that we were going to have this pandemic and that everything would be turned upside down. And we do not know what is going to be happening in the fall. Like, we just don't know.
Yeah, it's way too weird at this point.
I think all of that will make a huge difference. How does the U.S. look in November? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the question.
Yeah.
KUOW presented Inside 2020 on our YouTube channel this past June. To hear the full conversations, find a link at the Speakers Forum page. Just go to KUOW.org and click on the podcast button. Thank you for listening. Tune in again soon. Thank you.